Hi folks, it's Ray. Now that we have Lisa and Sophie on board, inspiring us and adding a great depth of experience and knowledge to the cast, we've decided to change things around a little bit. Going forward, our podcasts will be shorter so that they're more digestible for you, as one of the major items of feedback we've had is that our podcasts were slightly too long. But what we are going to do in exchange is we're going to release more frequent podcasts. So we aim to come out every week on a Monday as usual. This podcast, episode 10, was recorded at the same time as episode 9. It's a very interesting topic and raises questions about what we understand about modern leadership in times of crisis. So we hope you enjoy our conversation. Please get in touch with your thoughts and ideas and feedback. podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it. Can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed. They didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission. Listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion that you can't imagine. Don't hesitate. Rub the lamp, lad. So I was watching, I was listening to Any Questions on BBC Radio 4 a couple of weeks ago. And it was the question was around visibility of our Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the areas that have been flooded. And the accusation was that, you know, he'd been there during the campaign for the election, but hadn't been seen since. And the contributor on the panel said, the country needs leadership. We must have leadership. And it made me think, what does that mean? So, for example, when our Prime Minister was up there, you know, he was there and he had his wellies on and had his mop and bucket and stuff like that. But actually, take the politics out of it and take the personality out of it and everything else. In times of crisis, and we do have a few crises going on in the world at the moment, but even in terms of organisational crises where there's an existential threat to the organisation, or you know, there's a particular forced transformation that needs to occur. What do people mean when they say we want to see leadership? And what does that leadership look like? Is it a getting your wellies on and getting out and mopping the floor? Or is it something else? Is it a more reassurance? And, you know, we are going to do, you know, we're in control of the situation. We have a plan. We know what we're going to do. I'm engaging everybody to do what they need to do. We've got this, people. Is there an in-between way where there's a little bit more direct engagement with people? Because I've found in organizations before that when stuff is going on, boardrooms think they're the first to know when an organization is in trouble. Let me tell you, that ain't the case. Because the people on the ground who are making the widgets or doing the sales, they see what's going on. They may see that there's been a downturn in work. Things have got a bit quiet on the factory floor, or things are a little bit more challenging in terms of sales. There's not so many units going out the door. There aren't so many orders coming in. The forward order book is not looking as healthy as it ought to. Maybe we're having some problems with supply chains, that we always seem to be on stock with suppliers, suggesting that there's maybe some cash flow issues or something. So I think people on the ground in organizations, they're an awful lot more intuitive than some senior leaders give them credit for. So in a time of crisis, what do we mean by leadership?
I think it's interesting the question you posed at the very beginning, Ray, around should leaders wear wellies, as in should they roll up their sleeves, get the mop and bucket and muck in with everyone else? And I would absolutely agree with that and say, yes, they absolutely should.
Yeah.
Because I think in times of hardship, in times of trouble, if I think back to my career, I was in the automotive industry at the time when the recession hit in 2008. And nobody was buying cars. you know, people being made redundant left, right and centre. People did not have £15,000 to spend on a brand new car. And therefore, my industry was very rapidly declining. And in that moment in time, we all had to, including the senior management, we all had to muck in and say, right, what are we going to do about this? How is the organisation going to be affected? And what does that look like in terms of redundancies? Now, it isn't the same thing in terms of, yeah, I put my wellies on, you know, I went out into the shop floor and started making widgets. But what we did do was we said, we may have to make X many people redundant. To do this, it's going to cost X, Y, and Z. Or how about we take 10% off everyone's salary and we now get to keep that part of the workforce, we can keep them. And we all made that decision as an organisation to sacrifice 10% of our salaries so that we could still keep people in jobs. Now, from a leadership perspective, I think that sends a very, very key message for a leader to say, yes, take some of my pay, let's keep these people here, in the same way as it would be to say, there's a crisis on the production line, let me come down and help out. There's been a massive flood, there's been a massive leak, something's been destroyed as part of the project we're working on. Let me come down, let me come see what's going on, let me work with you to find out a solution. That sends an incredibly powerful message to the organisation about who you are as a leader, but also the culture of the organisation.
Yeah, it's interesting that you shared that anecdote, because that reminds me of a story from, again, from the financial crash of 2008. And it was an organization in the US. The chief exec was a guy called Bob Chapman. And rather than doing redundancies, what they agreed to do was that everybody would take an amount of unpaid leave.
Mm.
And actually what that created as a subculture was that people who were more financially secure, maybe slightly older, mortgages paid off and stuff like that, were actually taking more than their allowance of unpaid leave, so that people who were less able to afford
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the sort of culture that created in that organization. But what it also meant was the likelihood of that organization being able to be resilient in a crisis and then also be ready to hit the ground running as soon as they started to come out of the crisis was an awful lot more. I mean, they were a manufacturer as well. So while their competitors, when the financial turmoil ended and their competitors were trying to restaff and retrain, they already had a fully committed and engaged workforce.
Mm.
And they made hay then once the sun shone.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very interesting. And for me, with the whole should leaders wear wellies thing, I'm not necessarily sure that I want to see leaders with the mop and bucket. But what I do want to see is a leader that is able to empathize. It's very important for me. And so they're able to come out and engage with people at all levels of the organization and be authentic.
Mm.
Be able to say, look, I don't know your personal and your individual situation, but I empathize with your situation. I know these things can be troubling and unsettling, but I'm here to tell you that, you know, we've got a good, strong, stable team looking out for you, and we're going to do absolutely everything in our power to stabilize whatever the particular issue is. I think too many organizations, as soon as they have a bit of an existential threat or a crisis, they close in on themselves, and the senior managers kind of shut up shop and nothing comes out, only sort of staged press releases. And again, going back to what I'm saying, people on the ground in your organization, if you think that they don't feel what's going on, you're sadly mistaken, because they do. Now, I appreciate that for a lot of organizations, there is information that you can't necessarily share because it may have financial implications or stock market implications or whatever. However, how many times have we seen organizations where everything's fine, everything's fine, everything's fine, oh, we've just gone into liquidation. I was listening to a documentary on the radio yesterday by Laura Koonsberg on the BBC, and she was talking about in that decade, so from sort of 2000 to 2010, how people had lost faith in politics. And actually it was Gordon Brown that was saying that during the financial crash, he had a conversation with the chief executive of RBS one evening, who said, Gordon, we've got a bit of small cash flow issue. The next day, they went into liquidation. So what was going on in that organization that the chief executive didn't know that it was a little bit more than a cash flow crisis? And Gordon Brown himself said that one of the biggest mistakes that they made during that time was they were unable to communicate with people and reassure them that everything was going to be okay. Even though they knew that it would be and things would settle down and sort themselves out, they failed to effectively communicate with the country. Now, if I think of examples I've had in organizations I've worked with where, for example, downturn in work, looking at redundancies. I've had situations where the first thing that somebody has had in terms of communication is a letter from HR saying your role is at risk of redundancy. But I've been in other organizations where the senior leadership team have called everybody together in like a town hall meeting, said, this is the challenge we've got. This is one of the options. We're standing here in front of you now. Ask your questions. Ask anything you want. Doors open. And that was well in advance of them having to go into the formal process of putting people at risk of redundancy. They were upfront, almost in your face about it, and they engaged with their people. That's sort of two extremes of the situation.
It's so interesting that you mentioned Gordon Brown, because actually at the time when I was in the automotive industry and we were suffering with the decline with car manufacturing, Gordon Brown actually came and visited our site. So in terms of putting your wellies on and finding out what's actually happening in the industry, he spent some time going around different automotive. We were a supplier to the automotive industry, but actually working directly with the manufacturers as well to find out what was actually happening for this particular part of the world. And as a result of that, do you remember the £3,000 scrappage scheme that then came from that? Well, that was due to him having spent time with industries and finding out what was going on. So talking about putting your wellies on, I have no opinion on Gordon Brown either way, but putting your wellies on and going out there and finding out what's actually happening to the people working in this organisation and the output of it due to the recession, he put his wellies on, he came and spoke to us, and then as a result, the actual market did start to pick up with the £3,000 scrappage scheme anyway. But I think that was a
crappage scheme.
Yeah, not the cars that we were manufacturing.
Of course.
But I think that was quite key that he did that. Mm. And one of the other things I wanted to say and what Ray was talking about is around back to the floor exercises. That in many organisations that I've worked in, fact one that I'm working in now as well, is actually asking the senior leadership to go and spend time on supposedly on the shop floor in whatever industry that might be. And with my background being in social housing, as a senior leader in that organisation and with my director peers and the chief executive, we did go out and do that. I went and spent time in the care homes to understand what was it like to be a domestic assistant working with people that have got dementia. How can I possibly sit in my office and decide what the training programme should be for the organisation? Start putting out engagement and communication around the organisation's values, talking about what leadership should look like for the organisation. If I haven't actually experienced what the organisation does, and all of us leaders went away and did that, and actually because of that, there was so much intel that we had never been exposed to that were coming from the people that were right in the middle of the organisation. And I think that's where that conversation you were talking about, Ray, in terms of going out to your people and saying, okay, we may need to make redundancies, ask us any questions. If you have this back to the floor relationship with people and actually people know who you are, then they can already start telling you stuff before it gets to the point where redundancies happen, because you've started creating that pathway for communication to happen.
We used to do a lot of that at the college. So we'd have days where staff would swap jobs or they'd go and shadow. So the managers would go and shadow a lecturer, because a lot of the managers at the college they'd never been a lecturer. They didn't know what it was to stand up in front of a group. They were there to manage it as a business. But we also used to get a lot of the lecturers would have to go back out onto the workforce for a week every year, especially in trades and stuff where they may have worked in it for years and thought, I'm now going to go and teach. And they would be made to go out for a week every year, almost like on work experience, like their students did, to, yeah, kind of get up to date with what's out there and the challenges being faced. And so I think it's good leadership if they're seen to be doing what everyone else is doing.
That's what I loved about the American TV show, Undercover Boss. I mean, it's exactly that, where you're getting executive level people being put in these low level jobs and seeing what it's really like. And yes, you can say, okay, it's TV and there's a bit of entertainment, but actually when you looked at it, they were coming back to their boardroom and saying, wow, I found out so much that I didn't know. How did we not know these things were going on? Yeah. We need to sort these out. And the people taking part were rewarded for that in different ways. But often it involved changes in the way a company did things, or training was put in place that, you know, people said just wasn't there. So just from seeing it from a different perspective, but also realising how hard some of these people who are probably not paid very much are putting into that company. So I think, again, valuing their people.
I mean, it's great. It's great when bosses do that. They go out on the floor. It disappoints me a little bit when they are, and I've watched that program and the British version of it, how shocked they are at what they learn. And that tells me something about them and their leadership style, because one of the things you need to understand as a leader is what's going on the shop floor. And also what's going on out in the industry, and how are we being perceived by our customers. And there's an awful lot of tools and measures and stuff that ask all for all of this data to measure things that don't actually really tell you the true story. If you've got an organization where people feel that they can share information upwards and that it will be taken on board, it will be listened to, and it will be included in the decision-making process, that's quite a strong incentive to share information across all levels of the organization. I've worked with so many companies whose boardrooms are quite frankly deluded when it comes to what's actually going on in their organization, because they have a little bubble around them. There's no culture of feeling empowered to be able to say, we've got an issue here, this is going on. Nick Leeson, the guy who crashed Barings Bank, said that the reason he was able to get away with doing what he was doing was because there was an arrogance among the senior leadership within Barings Bank that they didn't need to be told what was going on. They knew everything. And yet he was both a trader and his own supervisor, and for that reason he was able to take the risks that he took and ultimately brought the organization down. And so I have very little sympathy for leaders who come out of the boardroom for a day or a week or a month and are incredibly shocked by what they learn. Shame on you. You should have known that. And I admire people for doing it. And I think as a behavior change, it's a great thing. But if it's a one-off, it's not going to work, because you've got no authenticity. And if no real change, like I noticed on that show, you know, they'd send people on holidays, like people who've maybe never been abroad in their life, and they get sent on a holiday. And that's great, and it's very tear-jerking and everything else. But actually, what I'd like to see is the follow-up program that says, right, I as the boss, I realize that I don't know what's going on in my organization, and these are the changes, the behavioral changes that I've made in my organization to make sure that I know what's going on.
Well, producers should be coming up with that program, because that's what I think with most of those kind of shows is they don't actually show the follow-up. But
because it's an entertainment thing. It's about giving people a nice warm feeling. And that's ultimately what it is.
I think it's part entertainment, but I do think there's
I think there'd, you know, be
genuine lessons for the company, and you would hope that, I think as some of them actually said, you know, this is not going to be a one-off now, and I've had a chance to do that. Well, hey guys in the boardroom, it's your turn soon. You're going to be going and doing that. So I think that kind of thing is good, where you can get that, as you say, not just kind of a one-off, and you know give everybody a £10 voucher and a holiday or whatever.
I don't think you can lead if you don't go out and experience everything either.
Yeah, great.
Because you don't understand the challenges of your staff. So even then, coming back to doing one-to-ones with them, you can sit there. That's where this sort of battle of they can say something to you and you have no idea, because you've literally got no idea. Because you've either not been there and done it, you don't get it, you don't get what systems they're working with. So I think any, especially any new leaders coming in, that's probably almost like their induction, is to go out and spend time with the people before they even try leading them. It's to go and find out, okay, what do you do? What's your day look like? And I think that's crucial time. But I think also then, when you then try to lead those people, they've probably almost got a bit of respect for you already, that you've been out and spent that time with them, and to try and understand what they do and how they do it. It's almost setting your own benchmark as a leader coming in, I think, to say, well, this is sort of what I expect. And yeah, and being able to make some changes. I know one of the biggest bits of advice I got going into my job was the guy that was doing it before me was great, but there were also lots of bits that weren't getting done. And that's been really good feedback for me, because now coming in as a new manager, I'm now able to make some of those changes. And yeah, that's had a really positive impact. But I wouldn't have done that had I not gone round and spoken to people and found out what was good, what they thought could be done better. So yeah, I think any leader's got to go out and do it.
But I guess, like, it depends on what you as an organization value. If as an organization everything is measured by what you do and how you do it, then actually you've kind of lost half the thing, because you're just measuring data. We produced this many widgets, we sold that many widgets, we've got this many people working at these different levels, you know, and there's all sorts of metrics. If your true value is that you are competing with yourself, for example, rather than trying to make things cheaper, faster, higher quality, whatever, then it almost drives you to have to get out and know what's going on in your organization. Because say, for example, you're a care provider. I don't know an awful lot about the care industry, but if I look at it as maybe a consumer, so say, for example, I had a parent who was receiving social care, so somebody was coming into the home. What would I value as a consumer, or as the sibling, the child of a consumer of that care? You know, I want to see people coming in with the right, with a good positive attitude, you know, well presented, caring, empathetic, etc., etc. If they're working in an industry which seems to be unfortunately driven by price, then that becomes a little bit more challenging. So if it's all about price, and I think this is where, as a society, we need to understand what we truly value. If things like care are sold purely on price points, then it's commoditized. And you can't really complain about the standard thereof, because it's been driven by lowest price. And I guess as well, for an organization, if you see what you do as a commodity, you will see the people who do it for you as a commodity, and therefore you may not necessarily be invested in understanding what's going on the shop floor, because you're measuring things differently. But I think an engaged leadership team, it's almost the first thing they think about every day. I'm sitting in the boardroom, what's going on out there? I need to go and find out.
I think when a leader decides to undertake to put their wellies on and go out and see what's actually happening, being part of the organisation at the heart of what the staff are actually doing, I think your mindset and the reasons you're doing it have got to be incredibly concise and very clear. Because I have come across one particular chief executive who went and did it because he felt like he had to. It wasn't a natural desire to do it. It was more of a, well, I better do it to make it look good. And he already knew what he wanted to find. So he went looking for those things and dismissed everything else. So it was almost a way of, well, I knew that because I'm such a good lead. I already had this intel. I've now gone out, I've seen it for myself, and that has validated my belief around the organisation, which wasn't true at all. It was very much a, I believe this team to be X, I believe them to be doing X, Y, and Z. I came back and I found that. If you ask the staff what that experience was like, it was very different. Secondly, you have to have the full intention to take on board and do something with the feedback that you get. So again, I have seen other senior leaders go out, do that particular exercise, fully undertake it with the right mindset, with good intention, but then actually when they've got the information back, they haven't acted on it. And that has been even more damaging to staff to do that than to not have bothered doing it at all. Because they've seen it firsthand and they haven't valued what they've seen.
We have a thing in the construction industry, which is it's a safety initiative, but it's called close calls. And the idea is that if you look at Heinrich's triangle, up the top is fatalities, but down the low level, if you capture all the low level stuff, you reduce the potential for more serious things happening further up the triangle. And so one of the things we have is close call reporting. It's an opportunity where people can say, oh, you know, I saw a trailing lead on the ground. It's an unsafe situation. So I made people aware. I was able to tidy it up and now the issue is gone. Or I wasn't able to tidy it up. It needs to be dealt with. But for now, I put like a temporary sign over it, whatever. And we constantly in the industry say to people, oh, you need to be raising close calls. You need to be raising close calls. Actually, and remembering what it was like sort of being on the tools myself. If you continue to raise all these things, but you never see anything coming back,
mm-hmm.
very quickly you get disengaged from
the
process.
You stop raising them.
Yeah, because you think, well, we're just doing this. This is a tick box exercise. Nobody's actually taking anything on board. And the most effective close call regimes are those where the organization regularly feeds back to their workforce to say, you said this, this is what we did about it. And that's incredibly effective because people actually then see that there's value in what they're doing
mm-hmm.
and that people up there in the management are actually taking on board what they're saying. And I guess that's the same with anything, whether it's close calls or whether it's, I think we should try this, I think we should do that. You know, as a leader, you've got to get on the ground and listen to people because that's where you will feel the real vibrations of the organization. You'll be able to identify early where the real risks and threats lie and where the real opportunities lie. And it should be an essential part, again, of your almost of your resilience planning, if you like. That I need to have my finger on the pulse of the organization, or at least have a culture in the organization where people are empowered to knock on your door and say, I've been made aware of this, I think we need to look at it, there's something here we need to do.
Mm.
And so many organizations, the leadership are inaccessible in that respect, or they turn up on a pre-prescribed time and go, right, we're doing our quarterly safety or leadership, senior leadership tour, tell us all about it. And everybody sits there dumbstruck because they're thinking, who are you? I've never seen you before, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I saw your pen portrait on some sort of a, you know, communique from the organization at some point, but I don't actually know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't trust you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not going to talk.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, Ray. And to what extent can I trust you with sharing with you how I really feel about my job, how I really feel about the processes, how I really feel about resources, how I really feel about the customer. How much can I trust you with that information if I've not had access to you before? And therefore, you're not going to get a really rich picture of what's happening for those individuals unless you've cultivated that trust beforehand. So the trust piece has to kind of come first before you decide to do this undertaking.
And that stems from values and culture. That's it's that foundation of, you know, what do we want this organisation to be? How do I want my people to be, and that's just it. That's just the way we are. It's not a thing we just stick on the wall and say, look, there's our list of 10 values, isn't that beautiful? Mm. It's actually, as people see us work and how we actually, as leaders and managers, show up, people don't need to look on the wall because they just see that's how we are.
Mm.
When they look at that, they go, yeah, that's right. Or if we're not doing that, we're open to actually people saying, I'm calling you out on number 8.
Yeah.
A lot of organisations rely on nouns to demonstrate their values without actually saying how they do it. So they'll say, you know, who was it I saw the other day? Their strapline was inspiring people. And I thought, to do what? Like, if I go out and murder people and in court say, they inspired me, have they met their values and objectives? There needs to be cause and effect in what you're saying. It's like, you know, you walk into an organization and they've got like posters around going, innovation. I'd like some more innovation from you today, sir, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
What? Like, what? Innovation is, I can knock on your door and say, we need to completely change the way we're doing that because it's not working for us. And you take it on board. That's real innovation. Because actually what you're looking to do is you're looking to challenge constantly what you're doing to try and improve it, because you're not competing against everybody else on price. You're competing with yourself on value.
Well, I just wanted to pose a question to the listeners, actually.
Yeah.
To say, to what extent are they, as a leader, prepared to put their wellies on? And if they do put their wellies on, to what extent are they prepared to deal with the information they get back? So just a question for you to think about.
Yeah, and added to that is, if you're on the shop floor and a leader turns up in wellies, how does that make you feel?
Mm.
What does that mean to you? You know, you don't have to, you can be anonymous, you don't have to reveal the organization or anything else, but, you know, do you feel in the organization you work in that there is a measure of authenticity there, or are they just there because somewhere on a metric it says that they have to be there on that day or whatever? We have a thing in construction, we call them leadership safety tours. And often organizations will set the requirements at the start of the year. So they'll say, like a senior manager, and we're talking like director level here, has to do 4 year. And often you'll see, I've seen, and I, you know, if somebody wants to have a private conversation with me about it, I'll name names, but I'm not going to do it on the podcast. But I'm sure these people probably know who they are, who all of a sudden, sort of like the last day or 2 days before the end of the particular quarter, all of a sudden you're flooded in leaders. There's senior managers everywhere, all going around ticking their little management safety tour things. And they rock up and they'll go up on a site and they'll say to a guy who's out in the snow pulling cables, oh, you know, how are you getting on? Yeah, grand. Because what's the point? You know, what is the point? You're just here to tick a box. Go away.
Yeah, we used to see that a lot in education. So at the time where Ofsted would get mentioned and suddenly everyone would be on it, and yet then it would kind of die off again. And yeah, I think eventually it got to a point where it became part of the culture, I suppose, that Ofsted was a word used most days, and it was kind of that change to being Ofsted ready all the time rather than this panic stations of... Yeah, everyone's scouting
around.
It was the
same with us.
Or actually,
CQC.
Because it's what you believe.
Yeah. Well, I think it built a culture of that it was a scary thing to go through. But it's kind of like, if you're doing what you should be doing every day,
this should be business as normal.
It shouldn't matter. Mm. So,
yes.
But yeah, that would suddenly, you'd see all these people turn up.
there's a whole other conversation there, experiences with Ofsted and schools.
Well, audits in general. So I can tell you every organisation I've ever worked with in the construction industry, you know when there's an audit going on. Because all of a sudden everybody's very interested in everything that's going on.
Yeah,
and you know when there's no audits going on.
Yeah.
I won't say nobody cares, but certainly you notice the difference.
Yeah, well, you suddenly see people that you know, you might have heard their name, but you've never met them, and suddenly they're there, like,
yeah,
wanting
taking
to
an interest in everything that you do, and you're kind of thinking, well, you weren't too bothered yesterday.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, as you say, it's probably a whole nother
conversation.
Yeah, and it comes into the whole marketing thing, because, you know, do you know what you believe? Do you know what you value as an organisation? As Simon Sinek would say, do you know your why? And is that reflected in how you live, breathe, market, everything else? It drives absolutely everything. And you know, because it's clear for everybody, when that isn't there, because it ultimately comes down to competing on price points. Whether it's competing for the resources by offering them the best salary, or whether it's competing to sell your goods or services because you're on a price game. If you're in the commodity, if everything is treated as a commodity, it would suggest that there's a disconnection between your why, your what, and your how. Incredible, gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now, have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower or a visionary? Can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't wanna fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need